Further evidence against the supposedly Franco-Rhenish origin of Eastern Jewry is provided by the structure of Yiddish, the popular language of the Jewish masses, spoken by millions before the Holocaust, and still surviving among traditionalist minorities in the Soviet Union and the United States. Yiddish is a curious amalgam of Hebrew, medieval German, Slavonic, and other elements written in Hebrew characters. Now that it is dying out, it has become a subject of much academic research in the United States and Israel. But until well into the 20th century, it was considered by Western linguists as merely an odd jargon, hardly worth serious study. As H. Smith remarked, quote, "Little attention has been paid to Yiddish by scholars. Apart from a few articles in periodicals, the first really scientific study of the language was Mises' Historical Grammar, published in 1924. It is significant that the latest edition of the Standard Historical Grammar of German, which treats German from the point of view of its dialects, dismisses Yiddish in 12 lines." End quote. At first glance, the prevalence of German loanwords in Yiddish seems to contradict our main thesis on the origins of Eastern Jewry. We shall see presently that the opposite is true, but the argument involves several steps. The first is to inquire what particular kind of regional German dialect went into the Yiddish vocabulary. Nobody before Mises seems to have paid serious attention to this question. It is to his lasting merit to have done so, and to have come up with a conclusive answer. Based on the study of the vocabulary, phonetics, and syntax of Yiddish, as compared with the main German dialects in the Middle Ages, he concludes, quote, "No linguistic components derived from the parts of Germany bordering on France are found in the Yiddish language. Not a single word from the entire list of specifically Moselle-Franconian origin, compiled by J.A. Ballast, has found its way into the Yiddish vocabulary. Even the more central regions of Western Germany around Frankfurt have not contributed to the Yiddish language. Insofar as the origins of Yiddish are concerned, Western Germany can be written off." Could it be that the generally accepted view, according to which the German Jews once upon a time immigrated from France across the Rhine, is misconceived? The history of the German Jews of Ashkenazi Jewry must be revised. The errors of history are often rectified by linguistic research. The conventional view of the erstwhile immigration of Ashkenazi Jews from France belongs to the category of historic errors, which are awaiting correction. End quote. He then quotes, among other examples of historic fallacies, the case of the Gypsies, who were regarded as an offshoot from Egypt, until linguistics showed that they came from India. Having disposed of the alleged Western origin of the Germanic element in Yiddish, Mises went on to show that the dominant influence in it are the so-called East Middle German dialects, which were spoken in the Alpine regions of Austria and Bavaria, roughly up to the 15th century. In other words, the German component which went into the hybrid Jewish language originated in the eastern regions of Germany, adjacent to the Slavonic belt of Eastern Europe. Thus, the evidence from linguistics supports the historical record in refuting the misconception of the Franco-Rhenish origins of Eastern Jewry. But this negative evidence does not answer the question how an East Middle German dialect, combined with Hebrew and Slavonic elements, became the common language of that Eastern Jewry, the majority of which we assume to have been of Khazar origin. In attempting to answer this question, several factors have to be taken into consideration. First, the evolution of Yiddish was a long and complex process, which presumably started in the 15th century or even earlier, yet it remained for a long time a spoken language, a kind of lingua franca, and appears in print only in the 19th century. Before that, it had no established grammar, and, quote, "it was left to the individual to introduce foreign words as he desires. There is no established form of pronunciation or spelling. The chaos in spelling may be illustrated by the rules laid down by the Judische Volksbibliothek. 1. Write as you speak. 2. Write so that both Polish and Lithuanian Jews may understand you. And 3. Spell differently words of the same sound which have a different signification. End quote. Thus, Yiddish grew, through the centuries, by a kind of untrammeled proliferation, avidly absorbing from its social environments such words, phrases, idiomatic expressions as best served its purpose as a lingua franca. But the culturally and socially dominant element in the environment of medieval Poland were the Germans. They alone, among the immigrant populations, were economically and intellectually more influential than the Jews. We have seen that from the early days of the Piast dynasty, and particularly under Casimir the Great, everything was done to attract immigrants to colonize the land and build modern cities. Casimir was said to have found a country of wood and left a country of stone. But these new cities of stone, such as Krakow or Lemberg, were built and ruled by German immigrants living under the so-called Magdeburg Law, that is, enjoying a high degree of municipal self-government. Altogether, not less than 4 million Germans are said to have immigrated into Poland, providing it with an urban middle class that it had not possessed before. As Poliak has put it, comparing the German to the Khazar immigration into Poland, quote, "The rulers of the country imported these masses of much-needed, enterprising foreigners and facilitated their settling down according to the way of life they had been used to in their countries of origin, the German town and the Jewish shtetl." End quote. However, this tidy separation became blurred when later Jewish arrivals from the West also settled in the towns and formed urban ghettos. Not only the educated bourgeoisie, but the clergy too was predominantly German, a natural consequence of Poland opting for Roman Catholicism and turning toward Western civilization, just as the Russian clergy after Vladimir's conversion to Greek Orthodoxy was predominantly Byzantine. Secular culture followed along the same lines, in the footsteps of the older Western neighbor. The first Polish university was founded in 1364 in Krakow, then a predominantly German city. As Kutura, the Austrian, has put it, rather smugly, quote, "The German colonists were at first regarded by the people with suspicion and distrust, yet they succeeded in gaining an increasingly firm foothold, and even in introducing the German educational system. The Poles learnt to appreciate the advantages of the higher culture introduced by the Germans and to imitate their foreign ways. The Polish aristocracy, too, grew fond of German customs and found beauty and pleasure in whatever came from Germany." End quote. Not exactly modest, but essentially true. One remembers the high esteem for German Kultur among 19th-century Russian intellectuals. It is easy to see why Khazar immigrants pouring into medieval Poland had to learn German if they wanted to get on. Those who had close dealings with the native populace, no doubt, also had to learn some pidgin Polish, or Lithuanian, or Ukrainian, or Slovene. German, however, was a prime necessity in any contact with the towns. But there was also the synagogue and the study of the Hebrew Torah. One can visualize a shtetl craftsman, a cobbler perhaps, or a timber merchant, speaking broken German to his clients, broken Polish to the serfs on the estate next door, and at home, mixing the most expressive bits of both with Hebrew into a kind of intimate private language. How this hodgepodge became communalized and standardized to the extent to which it did is any linguist's guess. But at least one can discern some further factors which facilitated the process. Among the later immigrants to Poland, there were also, as we have seen, a certain number of so-called real Jews from the Alpine countries, Bohemia and Eastern Germany. Even if their number was relatively small, These German-speaking Jews were superior in culture and learning to the Khazars, just as the German Gentiles were culturally superior to the Poles. And just as the Catholic clergy was German, so the Jewish rabbis from the West were a powerful factor in the Germanization of the Khazars, whose Judaism was fervent but primitive. To quote Poliak again, quote, "Those German Jews who reached the kingdom of Poland-Lithuania had an enormous influence on their brethren from the East. The reason why the Khazar Jews were so strongly attracted to them was that they admired their religious learning and their efficiency in doing business with the predominantly German cities. The language spoken at the Heder, the school for religious teaching, and at the house of the Gevir, the notable rich man, would influence the language of the whole community." End quote. A rabbinical tract from 17th century Poland contains the pious wish, "May God will that the country be filled with wisdom and that all Jews speak German." Characteristically, the only sector among the Khazarian Jews in Poland which resisted both the spiritual and worldly temptations offered by the German language were the Karaites, who rejected both rabbinical learning and material enrichment. Thus, they never took to Yiddish. According to the first All-Russian census in 1897, there were 12,894 Karaite Jews living in the Tsarist Empire, which, of course, included Poland. Of these, 9,666 gave Turkish as their mother tongue, that is, presumably their original Khazar dialect. 2,632 spoke Russian, and only 383 spoke Yiddish. The Karaite sect, however, represents the exception rather than the rule. In general, immigrant populations settling in a new country tend to shed their original language within two or three generations and adopt the language of their new country. The American grandchildren of immigrants from Eastern Europe never learn to speak Polish or Ukrainian and find the Jabberwocky of their grandparents rather comic. It is difficult to see how historians could ignore the evidence for the Khazar migration into Poland on the grounds that more than half a millennium later, they speak a different language. Incidentally, the descendants of the biblical tribes are the classic example of linguistic adaptability. First, they spoke Hebrew. In the Babylonian exile, Chaldean. At the time of Jesus, Aramaic. In Alexandria, Greek. In Spain, Arabic, but later Latino, a Spanish-Hebrew mixture written in Hebrew characters, the Sephardi equivalent of Yiddish. And so it goes on. They preserved their religious identity, but changed languages at their convenience. The Khazars were not descended from the tribes, but, as we have seen, they shared a certain cosmopolitanism and other social characteristics with their co-religionists.